If you're off to Detroit Metro for a flight today, you may encounter a new wrinkle in your routine. Specifically during takeoff, you might be able to leave your portable electronic device on during takeoff, indeed during the entire flight. The FAA, late last week, announced the policy change. There are some types of planes that are still vulnerable to interference from electronic readers and other devices, but the implication is not that many. It's still up to each airline to demonstrate that greater use of electronics will not interfere with the flight, but it appears they've seen this coming. And Delta has already performed all the necessary tests. A Delta spokesman says the paperwork's been submitted to the FAA and the approval could already have come, candidly. So you will not suffer through e-deprivation at all that we've come to associate during takeoff here. There's a dreadful few minutes when you're actually not connected to the wider e-world. And even that is slowly coming to an end, I guess. Later on this hour, a look ahead at holiday movies with MLive's John Serba and Current State's Emmanuel Berry. We'll have a quick recap of the MSU U of M game from Saturday and look ahead at the rest of the season with our Al Martin. At the top of the show, Republicans in the Michigan legislature want changes at the state's Court of Claims. That's the judicial body that decides legal actions against the state. Reformers, including our next guest, say it's expensive and wrong to focus the operations of the court in Ingham County. Senator Rick Jones of Grand Ledge supports a more statewide approach, making the Court of Claims a part of the Michigan Court of Appeals. Judges hearing claims would be appointed by Supreme Court justices. Now, critics of the move say it's political, since Ingham County judges are typically aligned with Democrats. Court of Appeals judges would be appointed by the Supreme Court, currently with a majority of Republicans. Here to discuss his support of the move, some responses to it, and other legislative news, Chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Senator Rick Jones. Good to see you.
Hello, good morning.
Explain for our listeners here your reasons for supporting this move of the Court of Claims out of the Ingham County Circuit Court.
Well, every couple of years, it's my job to look at judicial reform. We add judges or cut judges where needed. For example, Macomb County is the most underjudged county in the state, and we're actually adding three circuit judges to Macomb County. Other counties are going to see a cut. So part of this reform, looking at the judicial changes, I got to studying the Court of Claims, and I questioned, why would it all be in one county? It makes no sense. It's quite a burden to that county. And so I asked, what happened historically? Well, historically, originally, everything was handled administratively by basically like an administrative magistrate. Then a system was developed where circuit judges would come from all over the state. So we had judges from all over the state that would take turns being the Court of Claims, where you sue the state of Michigan. And I wondered, well, when did this get changed? Well, it got changed in the 70s. So I contend if there were any political shenanigans, they were done in the 70s when you focused Court of Claims in simply one court, one county. Now, people would say it would be just as inappropriate if I said, okay, from now on, all Court of Claims will be in Clinton County or Eaton County. Doesn't make any sense. So what I want to do is move it to appointments from the Supreme Court. They will come out of the appeals court. There will be four judges, and one at a time, they will serve as our Court of Claims. You'll still have an appeals to the appeals court. Does not cut out any appeal process, and from there to the Michigan Supreme Court.
Now, you alluded to some cost pressures in Ingham County here. Isn't it true that the Court of Claims gets extra money from the state to operate in Ingham County?
I understand that the County of Ingham does get a little subsidy to assist with the cost. You know, each judge costs, on the average, $450,000. In some cases, depending on the county, it could be $500,000 per judge. So there's quite a cost. And when the Court of Claims was first formed in Ingham County back in the 70s, they added a judge to Ingham County. If Ingham County feels it's too much of a burden when the Court of Claims is taken away, I would be happy to look at cutting the judge if that's a problem.
Now some critics have also said that the Court of Claims accounts for only 2% of the Ingham Circuit Court's caseload. How would shedding that little of its caseload enable it to eliminate one judge?
Well, again, that would be up to the county commissioners and the judges to advise me if they want somebody cut. I'm not saying I'm going to cut, just saying that that would be a possibility.
And you part of your responsibilities then is to look at the number of cases that pop up in a particular county and match the number of judges as efficiently as you can. Is that part of the, that's this process?
That's very accurate. You know, a couple of years ago, we cut 40 judges by attrition across the state. Years ago, I think judges were added as political plums. You know, it's nice to be able to have more judges appointed in a district. And so we got an awful lot of judges in areas that didn't need that many judges. And certainly, this is a great cost. We want taxpayers not to be burdened with judges they don't need. And so we were able to cut around 40 judges here a couple of years ago.
Now, this move has been assailed as highly partisan from Democrats. I know Senator Whitmer dislikes that Court of Appeals judges who would handle these future claims would be appointed by the Supreme Court. Could you respond to that?
Well, you know, the Supreme Court is nonpartisan. Now, she says, well, they're appointed currently. Apparently, she thinks there's more Republicans than Democrats leading judges or something.
A lot of people seem to think that.
It goes back and forth constantly. You know, we have a Democrat governor, then we have a Republican governor. This state goes back and forth constantly. I don't think there's any one trend. But obviously, I think if there were any political shenanigans, it was back in the 70s when they decided to put all of the Court of Claims into just one county. Makes no sense.
Aren't there costs associated with with a new site, though, for this court and staff and such things?
I don't believe so. I think there's adequate room in the Hall of Justice and other areas in the state that we could use. Certainly we have appeals court judges now that have courtrooms that could be utilized. And also, you'd be able to file your case in four different locations, Grand Rapids, Detroit, Troy, as well as Lansing.
Now, Democrats are also criticizing how quickly this measure is moving. Has there been enough discussion and deliberation of this?
I think there has, and I think it's important to move quickly because you have cases coming into the Court of Claims. You don't want people held in limbo. You want the attorneys to know where the cases are going to go, how they're going to be handled. So I think it's important to move quickly and not leave things out there in limbo.
It really was just a matter of a few days, wasn't it? I mean, when did you first file this, and when did it move out, and when did it get a vote? It was really...
Well, I filed it in 1 week, and the next week I had a hearing in Judiciary. This is quite common. If you follow Senate Judiciary, we move rapidly. We do a lot of work and a lot of important topics. For example, tomorrow I'll be taking up mental health courts, which is an extremely important process for the state, to defer somebody with mental illness into treatment instead of into jail. So we move quickly, we work hard. That is the Senate Judiciary, and I would recommend you ask any senator that sits on it.
What's been the response in the House to the bill, to the Court of Claims measure?
My understanding is they're going to have a hearing on it tomorrow, that they also think it's an important topic, and they're responding.
You submitted we're talking with State Senator Rick Jones. You submitted a six-bill package to toughen limits on the use of state bridge cards. These are the cards that welfare recipients use to buy what they need. What would those bills do exactly?
Well, a bridge card doesn't just provide food for the needy. A bridge card also can provide cash assistance. Now, what is that meant to pay for? Clothing for your children, gas to go look for a job, pay the electric bill, the heat bill, buy the necessities of life that aren't food, toilet paper, toothpaste, that sort of thing. Last year, I discovered that just one casino out of the 26 took in $87,000 in cash from the bridge card. They were able to put them in the ATMs and casinos, draw that much out, and then obviously They were probably playing blackjack and drinking booze on that welfare money. It made no sense. I blocked the casinos last year. This year I'm blocking horse tracks, strip clubs, and liquor stores. Now, liquor stores are defined as a store that sells more than 50% of their profit from alcohol.
What's the response been like to that?
Well, everybody's very supportive of my bills. There were a few stores in Detroit that were nervous. They thought that they were the only stores around, and they didn't really understand until we explained to them they can still sell all the food. They just won't be issuing cash through the ATMs. That temptation won't be there to get the cash, turn right around, and buy alcohol. I can tell you that I have deep personal feelings about this because my daughter takes in foster kids. I become the foster grandpa, and 16 different children, at least half, were food deprived, didn't have proper clothing because their moms were addicted to illegal drugs or alcohol or some other substance instead of taking care of the children. So I feel we should work very, very hard to make sure the bridge card money and benefits go where they're supposed to be.
And on your agenda today is work on mental health board reform. This is encapsulated in Senate bills 575 through 578. It also involves mental health courts. Tell us what those are about.
Well, currently in Michigan, we have drug and alcohol courts, which are meant to defer people into treatment instead of just putting them in jail and throwing away the key. This can save a lot of money for taxpayers. Obviously, if you can get somebody rehabbed, restored back to society, it's better than just leaving them in jail. We hope to do the same with mental health courts. Allow the judges to work with the defense attorneys, get the clients deferred into mental health treatment instead of just locking them away. As a former jail administrator and a sheriff, I think this is extremely important.
Senator Rick Jones, chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
Its current state on 90.5 WKAR, buying a home is fraught with difficult decisions and navigating the process can be daunting. But for potential home buyers in the Lansing area, there's at least one place to get some help, the Home Buyers Club, a partnership between the Ingham County Land Bank and the Center for Financial Health. The Home Buyers Club works with potential home buyers, particularly ones with less than stellar credit and little to no savings. The program began last spring but had its official kickoff earlier this fall. Here to tell us more about the Home Buyers Club, Denise Kaiser, the executive director of the Center for Financial Health. Hi, Denise.
Hi, good morning.
And she is joined by Monica Mayer, who's a recent homeowner, thanks to the Home Buyers Club. Congratulations.
Thank you, and good morning to you as well.
Welcome to Current State. How long have you been in your new home?
Since last Wednesday.
Wow.
Very recent.
You've still got things in boxes then.
Absolutely.
I imagine. Denise, you help folks with all kinds of housing issues, including purchasing and foreclosure, both ends of the spectrum. From your vantage point, talk to us about the housing situation right now in Lansing. What kind of market is it?
Well, I think it's turning, and I think we're coming into a much more positive housing market here in Lansing. We have been doing really well over the past 12 to 14 months. We're seeing less foreclosures. Certainly, we still have to deal with some foreclosure issues, but we're seeing more positive feedback from the market in that we're seeing more buyers coming to the marketplace. We're seeing homes sell a little bit quicker than they have in the past 4 or 5 years. And we're seeing some great programs that can help people get into a home for the first time or maybe even the second time.
So you've got inventory that's loosened up, and you've got people in financial situations who are actually the recession is further behind them. They're not as much in the red.
Correct.
And they can realistically consider buying a home. Now, you're assisting with more purchases than foreclosures. I'm really curious when that transition, when did the balance tip from one to the other?
Well, we saw sort of an equalization last year in 2012. Prior to that, at one point, 80% of our business model was assisting those folks in foreclosure. In 2012, we saw that about 50% of our assistance was going out to help people in the search of purchasing a home. And the other 50% certainly was still trying to help folks hold on to their homes and stabilize. Mm-hmm.
And you help people in Ingham County?
Well, we're a certified agency nationwide. There's about 25 agencies across the country who do what we do. There's about 60 here in Michigan. Our primary target area is Ingham, Eaton, and Clinton counties, but certainly we can help anyone within the state of Michigan in need. We have a homebuyer education course that's available online. Certainly we prefer that folks come in and get the one-on-one interaction in a classroom environment, but for those who aren't able to make it downtown Lansing, we have that available online at our website.
Monica, how'd you find out about the Home Buyers Club?
I found out through the Ingham County Land Bank. I was looking at some of the homes from Ingham County Land Bank, and they referred me to the Center for Financial Health and to meet with a financial counselor one-on-one to get my finances in order to be able to qualify to purchase a home, and also took the home buyer education course, which was incredibly helpful in purchasing a home and
online.
Being informed. No, I did it in person.
Okay.
I went downtown, and the class was very, very helpful.
What one or two things that you learned were really most important to you?
The most important thing I learned, I feel, is that navigating the home buyer the process, which I knew nothing about. This was the very first time I have bought a home. And making decisions, smart decisions along the way, choosing a realtor, choosing a lender, how to read the fine print, and make sure that you're making smart choices in the home buyer process.
How stressful was your closing?
Not very stressful at all, although I was very nervous when I went in. But before I joined the Home Buyer Education, Home Buyers Club in July, I was completely stressed out because I was denied by lenders. I was not getting the results I wanted, and it looked like I wasn't able to purchase a home at the time.
Now, did you have to make who ended up being your lender? Can we talk about that? I mean, how
yes.
did that work out?
I have met with Jonathan at the Center for Financial Health, and he has found lenders who were working with people in my situation that were the best match for me. And I was able to find my lender ended up being the Summit Bank, which is a community bank.
Summit
local
Community Bank.
Right.
Summit Community Bank. And they were more than helpful in trying to find the right mortgage for my situation.
Did you offer somebody from the Home Buyers Club at the closing, Denise? I'm just curious if somebody was actually there at the closing besides your agent.
I attended the closing with
you
Monica.
Did.
Her
okay.
housing counselor wasn't able to attend, so we try to make sure that we're there to assist, because at the closing table you may have 10 different people, from the agent to the lender to the seller and the buyer.
And dozens of sheets of paper to sign.
Yes, certainly.
Most of them inscrutable, as it turns out. So
true.
That always creates a lot of stress. What, Monica, was your issue a down payment? Was it income or cash flow or both?
My situation was rather complicated. I found myself to be a single parent a couple of years ago. And I also, as a result, had to file for bankruptcy, which made the home buyer process even more challenging. I was not informed as what to do with my down or my saved up money. You know, how does it work exactly? Where do you put the money? Do you put it in savings? Do you keep it at home? So I had a lot of questions about how to purchase a home. Like I said, I knew nothing about it. And by joining the Home Buyers Education Club, I was inundated with all this important information that helped me make the right choices. And down payment, I did not have at all with my income. So the Ingham County Land Bank does have down payment assistance available for those who qualify. And thanks to them, I was able to purchase a home.
Denise, how many people are you unable to help, though? There must be some percentage of people that come to you. Maybe you're able to provide education, mm-hmm. but ultimately they're not able to cross an important threshold and become a home buyer. How does that play out?
Well, certainly not everyone is ready for home ownership. People become ready for home ownership at different points in their lives, and sometimes it's not the right choice, depending on your situation. So we try to focus more on the education piece, and Monica made a good point. She wasn't sure about what to do with her savings and work on her credit issues. When you think about how we learn about money, everyone learns about money differently. Everyone learns how to save differently. So those are habits that we acquire at a very young age. Attending the Home Buyers Club, joining the Home Buyers Club, and attending different financial workshops, learning how to work on your credit, learning how to work on saving money, accessing the resources that are available to help you do those things. So our initial attendance in the Home Buyers Club is certainly to introduce folks to that possibility, that goal of home ownership. But the bigger picture is we're helping people improve their credit. We're introducing them to affordable savings products. So I think the bigger picture is we're more focused on helping people manage their money in a better way to become more financially healthy. And certainly you're right, we can't create all of the people that join our Home Buyers Club, we can't create homeowners in each one of them. But certainly we can help further their financial health in a variety of different ways as their membership grows throughout the club.
Talk to me a little bit more about the down payment piece, though. I mean, how do you navigate that, and what's the lowest percentage of down payment that you would really advise anybody to? Below what point would you discourage someone from buying a house?
Well, as a housing counselor, I have several different views on that. Certainly, we want to put people into homes and have them sustain that home ownership. So although Monica accessed down payment assistance, we also counseled her in saving money throughout the process. So when she moved into the home, she put down 1% of the purchase price in a down payment. But she has grown her savings so that she will be more stable as a homeowner and if something arises. So 1% is typically the lowest. We recommend if you're putting just 1% down that you have $5,000 or $6,000, $7,000 in the bank, so that if something happens along the way, you have a loss of income, a family member becomes sick, you can still make that mortgage payment and live comfortably. Lenders these days are asking anywhere from 3.5% down payment to 20% down payment, depending on the type of loan a buyer might qualify for. But we're lucky that here in Lansing, we have some funds coming from the Neighborhood Stabilization Program, the NSP program, which is available throughout the country in different ways. And what those funds are used for is to help stabilize neighborhoods. Because when you look at some of our Lansing neighborhoods, you'll see that some properties are vacant, some properties are blighted. There's a lot of renters in these neighborhoods. And the only way we can turn those neighborhoods around, in our opinion, is to get homeowners into those neighborhoods, because homeowners tend to be more involved in their community. And another important benefit of being a homeowner is that children of homeowners tend to do better in school. Their math and reading scores are mm-hmm. higher. They tend to stay in school longer and finish. They have less behavioral problems.
Stability, yeah.
Stability, yes.
Denise Kaiser is the executive director of the Center for Financial Health, which counts the Home Buyers Club as one of its programs. And Monica Mayer has been a participant in the Home Buyers Club, and she is a new homeowner. Congratulations and thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. MSU cello professor Seren Bhagratuni and assistant professor of piano Minsu Son performed tonight at the newly renovated Fairchild Theater. WKAR brings you that concert in a live broadcast tonight at 7:30. Their program includes works by Schubert, Shostakovich, and César Franck. WKAR's Peter Wharf met with Seren Bhagratuni in his studio last Friday to talk about tonight's performance.
all pieces on my program, at least the first half, those are my favorite pieces. Mm-hmm. And I have to confess, the Shostakovich Sonata, I never played while I was back in Russia.
Really?
Yes, because it was kind of a rebellion decision. Mm-hmm. Everybody was playing that sonata. And I said, you know what, I would like to play Prokofiev, because we had a choice. Mm-hmm. And then when I came to United States, which was a little bit later in my life, when I was 27, I started learning that piece. And you know, when you put aside all the quote-unquote traditions of performing that sonata, then you can read that piece completely differently.
What are the traditions?
Well, traditions, there are certain performing traditions. Okay, do ritardando here, do accelerando there, play this passage like that, etc. When you don't have all those formalities, then you read the music differently. And I started learning about Shostakovich and his life really in the West. Why? Because I didn't have vast amount of information back in Moscow where I was studying, because Shostakovich was one of the gods, of course, and everything about him written was pro, party pro, yes, he was a great composer, etc., but we did not know how much this person suffered, really, and I was too young to know. But now when I read all the literature and stuff, it's just amazing how did this person create so much incredible music under those conditions. And you know, this sonata reflects especially the difficult period of his life, because Opus 40, it's in the 30s he wrote that sonata, when everybody was scared, especially in 1937, 38, when who knows who's going to come at night and pick you up, and how many friends you lost. And all the movements of this sonata reflect that stage of mind of the composer. And sometimes it's pretty scary.
That comes, as you said, in the mid-30s, around the time of the opera Lady Macbeth, which didn't end very well for Shostakovich. This comes around the same time as the Fourth Symphony, another landmark piece in the history of music, which also did not result in a very good experience for Shostakovich.
True. Yes, I mean, all those pieces, except Cello Sonata, I think, was written politically correct for the person who was Mr. Kubatsky, who was responsible for creation of the Soviet state rare instruments collection. It means that he would walk from the apartment to apartment with a bunch of soldiers on his back and expropriate all those instruments and create that collection, and himself actually end up with very nice cello, which I was playing on for a couple of years. The collection gave it to me and to go to competitions. It was made by Stradivari, early 1700s. It was incredible cello. It's one of those cellos which were taken from probably a former royalty or nobility of Russia, which, of course, some of them fled the country, some of them stayed there, some of them went under, so they were conveniently stripped of their beautiful instruments. Collection was created, yes.
Thank you.
Let's move on to the second half of the program and the sonata by César Franck, in this case for cello and piano, but it's very well known as a violin sonata.
It's a violin sonata, although I think it sounds incredibly beautiful on cello also. And on any instrument which plays this music, it does really grab your attention.
It's a piece with this idée fixe idea where the theme from the first movement comes back in sort of different and surprising ways, sometimes, you know, sort of rising from the mist, sometimes just coming right down on top of you.
That's right, yes. And he uses that material incredibly wise, plus that tragic melody which comes at the end of the third movement and repeats twice in the last movement, it grows from simple mezzo forte, first time to forte, second time fortissimo, third time triple forte, fourth time the grandioso thing. It's just very nicely follows from the movement to movement. I really enjoy playing this music, and I didn't play it much, not very often, but every time I play, I find something new. Even the relationship between tempos in the second movement, they could be very freely dispersed, and all the first movement is just a fantasy. It's an incredible stuff. How do you see yourself probably in the boat, the nice waters, I don't know, or something. Something like that. I don't know. And piano part is incredibly difficult.
Yes.
That's I have
right.
to do. I have to.
It's really a sonata for both instruments. In some cases, a string player might play a piece that is weighted slightly more for the stringed instrument. But in this case, it's a true partnership, if not even heavier weighted for the piano.
Yes, yeah. I agree with you. A piano is heavier, except it's done not the way Beethoven would do. Beethoven, for instance, he would say sonata für Klavier und Violoncello, or cello obbligato, even the first two sonatas, or Brahms. They realized that this is mostly done by piano and cello is like just a helper. But in Franck, for instance, violin is having this major role, except the piano has most of the notes. Yes, all the material is there too, yes.
Sorenbach Gratuni is professor of cello at the College of Music at Michigan State University. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Peter, very much.
Folk singers, hustlers, and samurai all are part of this year's holiday film lineup. John Serba, entertainment reporter and film critic for MLive and the Grand Rapids Press, gave current state's Emmanuel Berry the rundown of this season's upcoming films. They started with The Bad, which included two films starring Robert De Niro.
De Niro's kind of doing the same thing he's been doing for a long time and probably just cashing the paycheck and not challenging himself. But it's especially egregious because he's co-starring with Sylvester Stallone in a movie about old guys who are former boxing rivals who get back in the ring with each other.
And that's called Grudge Match.
Yes, it's called Grudge Match. And you just, you know, both of these guys, their iconic roles are boxers. You know, De Niro is Jake LaMotta and Raging Bull, and of course, Stallone is Rocky. And it just seems extra exploitation-y.
He's also going to be in Las Vegas, which is The Hangover with old people. The cast members, Michael Douglas, Morgan Freeman, Kevin Klein. What are these guys doing? Is this worth watching for the spectacle of it, at least?
I don't know. I mean, these are all really, really great actors.
Yeah.
but just the concept is just so awful and cloying. And I don't know if I could stomach it. You know, you just look at the trailer and you just cringe. I mean, and there have been these type of movies before, like Space Cowboys with Clint Eastwood and Tommy Lee Jones as the you know, old guy astronauts and things like that. But this seems like, you know, more of an awful mainstream comedy and an excuse to, you know, make Viagra jokes.
All right, yeah. Enough with the bad films, because there are actually so many good films that I am actually dying to see this holiday season. So let's start with American Hustle, directed by David C. Russell. It's got stellar cast. We've got Christian Bale, Bradley Cooper, Jeremy Renner, Amy Adams, Jennifer Lawrence. There's a great cast, a great director. Is the story going to hold up?
I don't want to say he's due to make a bad movie, but let's face it, he took the best elements of his last two films, The Fighter and Silver Linings Playbook, and put them together. So you've got this, like, super movie. and it's set in the 70s, and, you know, it's... If I was a gambling man, I would say there's going to be a bunch of Oscar nominations coming out of this. This is going to be well worth seeing. If it's as good as Silver Linings or The Fighter, I don't know. But even if it's not that good, it'll still be pretty good. So, and Louis C.K. is in it as well, and he's just...
Yeah, how's a comedian going to do in a more serious role?
Well, Louis C.K., I think, has proved himself to be a pretty versatile guy. If you've ever seen his FX show, Louis, mm-hmm. Which he writes and directs and stars in, and, you know, that's his baby and his project. I frankly wish he wouldn't star in other people's movies and just keep doing that show.
Yeah.
But, you know, to add him into the mix, why not? The more the merrier.
Well, another film that I'm really looking forward to seeing is Inside Llewyn Davis. This is a Coen Brothers film. They've retold Homer's Odyssey. They've done classic westerns. What's the story of this film?
It stars Oscar Isaac, who was in Drive, and he was really underappreciated in Drive. So he's kind of a newcomer, and he's playing a folk singer in the early 60s. He lives in New York City, and he's trying to make a name for himself in that scene. The vibe I'm getting from this is that people are comparing this to A Serious Man, which was a couple of Coen Brothers movies ago, which is one of their more understated efforts. Mm-hmm. And I also think it's one of their best ones, you know. I mean, you love True Grit, and you love Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? They're these big movies with big characters. But they can do the small ones really well, too, and I'm absolutely fascinated to see this. And the throwback to Oh Brother is they have T-Bone Burnett producing the soundtrack to this as well.
Yeah,
so.
And he's pairing with Marcus Mumford. I actually have, this is a clip of the lead Isaac. He's accompanied by Mumford on this song called Fare Thee Well.
If I had wings like Noah's dove, I'd fly the river to the one I love. Oh, fare thee well, my honey, fare thee well.
After seeing Oscar Isaac in Drive, I wouldn't really think he had that voice, but this guy seems to be an actor of many talents. Do you kind of see this as a breakout role for him in any ways?
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, he's getting the chance to work with, you know, some of the best filmmakers in the business right now. So if they don't see it in him, he doesn't have it. So this may be a breakout role. I think the potential for this movie is really high, because that's a really rich kind of setting. I'm sure it'll have some of those typical Coen Brothers idiosyncratic elements as well. So
we have two veterans in the next film I want to talk about, Emma Thompson and Tom Hanks in a Disney movie about making a Disney movie. Oh, just the untold story of the making of Mary Poppins, which centers around some creative differences between Walt Disney and the author P.L. Tavers.
Mary Poppins is not for sale. I won't have her turned into one of your silly cartoons.
Says the woman who sent a flying nanny with a talking umbrella to save the children.
seems like an interesting story, but I was a little surprised to see this on your most anticipated list. Why do you want to see this?
Well, because I'm a fan of the movies. Let's face it. And this is a story that I don't think a lot of people realize that it, you know, Mary Poppins was a movie 20 years in development. Obviously, it became one of the most cherished musicals of all time. And well, first of all, two reasons. Emma Thompson really hasn't done a lot of meaty, interesting things in quite a while, and which is kind of upsetting, frankly.
She's because she's great. Yeah.
Yeah, she's amazing. She has such charisma. And then Tom Hanks playing Walt Disney. It's like. Duh! Of course you're going to cast Tom Hanks as Walt Disney. So to see them together in this kind of film, in a movie about the movies, I think this has a chance to go to Oscar. You know, they're already talking Tom Hanks getting a couple of Oscar nods this year for this and Captain Phillips, which opened a few weeks ago.
The year of Tom Hanks. Welcome,
yeah,
everyone.
Maybe.
This holiday season, we also have a couple of films based off of books. We have the second part of the Hobbit trilogy, The Desolation of Smaug. I was actually surprisingly disappointed with The Hobbit. Do I give this one a chance? Do I let Peter Jackson take another $10 from me?
I think so. I mean, The Lord of the Rings trilogy, I think, is one of the most remarkable filmmaking achievements ever. It's such a stunning, 10 hours of film. And so he's kind of, you go into these movies with a lot more expectations than you might with anything else. At least I do, And so seeing the first Hobbit, it was a little disappointing because it seemed a little too drawn out, a little too many side trips off the main path, the dwarves just how many hairdressers do they have on set for these dwarves?
Right.
You know, everyone talks about the Boston Red Sox beards. What about these dwarves?
It's ridiculous.
I think if the first Lord of the Rings trilogy is any indication, the first movie there was the weakest as well, because it's setting everything up, and hopefully that the Hobbit trilogy can kind of build on that kind of momentum as well. Obviously, introducing the dragon, and he's voiced by Benedict Cumberbatch.
Come now, don't be shy. Step.
Who's one of the hottest names in Hollywood right now. I think that'll give this a little shot in the arm. Tolkien fans are going to go see this anyway. They loved the first movie. They're absolutely apologetic about it in every way. They're going to defend it. Last year, the first Hobbit movie was one of the top grossing international movies of the entire year. There's no reason this isn't going to be a hit, even if you walk out of it going, it was no Return of the King.
Nothing is ever Return of the King. Another work of literature turned film we have coming out is The Secret Life of Walter Mitty, and this is actually the second time it's been on the silver screen, the first time being in 1947, starring funny man Danny Kaye.
Starring Danny Kaye, eight times as funny in eight hilarious roles. One as Walter Mitty, the dauntless sea rover, Anatole Mitty, the Mad Hatter, Captain Mitty, Ace of Aces.
The original Walter Mitty highly deviated from the original work of the story. Ben Stiller's doing this version. Is it going to feel more true to Thurber's version, or is this all Ben Stiller's imagination and with his own flavor?
Well, I think it might be a little bit of both. If I recall correctly, the original was criticized for not being as true to Thurber.
Yeah.
And obviously this one is set in the modern day. And I'm pretty sure Thurber didn't write in scenes with his characters talking on cell phones.
Yeah, so, probably not.
And you know, obviously, special effects and things like that have come a long way. So I think you're gonna see more integrated, more visually interesting fantasy sequences. Ben Stiller, I don't know if people realize, is a pretty darn good director. You know, I don't know if he's quite the Ben Affleck, but. He did Tropic Thunder a few years ago, and that was really quite good. And this will be interesting because he's got a pretty good cast behind him: Sean Penn, Kristen Wiig, Patton Oswalt has a role, Shirley MacLaine is in it, and it's a it's a story that a lot of people, anyone who paid attention and did their homework in English class, are familiar with this story.
Yeah.
And, you know, so it'll be interesting to see what Stiller, what he does with it.
One genre that's we're kind of missing this holiday season is comedy, except for with the exception of Anchorman. Is there anything else we're going to be able to laugh at this season?
Well, even though they're not billed as straightforward comedies, there will be comedic elements in movies like American Hustle and Llewyn Davis, just because, you know, those filmmakers do a really good job of kind of defying categorization. Otherwise, you know, the stuff that is, you know, manufactured to be comedies like Anchorman 2, that is going to be a big hit, I think, just because there's kind of a dearth of real quality comedies coming out in the next couple of months. We talked about Grudge Match, that's a comedy. Last Vegas is a comedy. There's another Tyler Perry Madea Christmas movie coming out. I think Anchorman is really going to, you know, flourish. And it might also be that the studios are looking and going, we're not going to compete with Anchorman 2. Let's release our movie in the spring.
Lastly, as you mentioned in your MLI preview online, we have no Twilight this holiday season. Are we going to make it, John? Can we survive without Twilight?
I fuel myself with hatred for Twilight movies and Adam Sandler films. There's no Adam Sandler films this holiday season either. So what am I going to find to really strongly dislike? You know, I don't know. It's going to be a surprise this year, perhaps.
Well, I'm looking forward to reading it. John, as always, it's a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you for having me on, as always.
John Serba, entertainment reporter and film critic for MLive and the Grand Rapids Press.
MSU football undefeated in the conference, sitting atop the Legends Division, climbing in the national rankings, an impressive 8-1 on the season, and with a few thoughts on the Michigan game on Saturday. It's WKAR's Al Martin, host of Current Sports on AM 870 and on WKAR-TV every Thursday night. Hi, Al.
How you doing, Mark?
Good morning. What are you going to remember from Saturday? What are you going to remember?
In a couple of years, years and years down the line, 10 years, 20 years down the line, Mark, I don't know if I will ever see an MSU defense as good as what we saw this past week. I mean, that was the story of the game. I mean, they held Michigan to negative 48 rushing yards. That's the first time this has ever happened in this rivalry. It was the biggest margin of victory for MSU over Michigan since 1967. I mean, they were unbelievable. I mean, Devin Gardner didn't have a chance to breathe. He was sacked about 7 times. Anytime they tried to run the ball was non-existent. And you know, it's so funny. We were sitting in the press box with my fellow colleagues of mine watching the game. And we couldn't figure out the game plan offensively for Michigan because they didn't have time to set up one. Every time you look, Devin Gardner was eating grass the entire game. So that was the story of that game, Mark.
Let's look at the rest of the schedule here now. It's amazing how quickly the season has flown by. It's Nebraska, Northwestern, and Minnesota. How important are these last three games? What hangs in the balance here?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, we talked about on Current Sports last week. I thought whoever won this Michigan to Michigan State game this past Saturday was going to win the Legends Division, because if you look at the road for Michigan State after this, you do have Nebraska, Northwestern, and you finish up at home against Minnesota. Those are all winnable games if Michigan State's defense plays consistently, which they have been this entire season, and if the offense plays relatively average, if you will, which kind of Cook has done. He's a great game manager. We'll be talking about that on. I got some points to make about that on the show as well, if you tune in today. But, yeah, MSU, definitely all three winnable games. The thing about Michigan now, who's now, you know, they have their second loss now. If you look at the Big Ten standings right now, they have Nebraska, Northwestern, Iowa, and they still have to play Ohio State.
Yeah.
And Ohio State right now is pretty good, Mark, if you haven't heard.
We all know what happened on Saturday, that's for sure.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
So, and as awesome as this defense is, it is the offense that's grabbing more attention more and more. What's happening now that wasn't happening those first few weeks? Is this execution?
Yeah, definitely execution. I think right now, Connor Cook has really impressed me in the aspect of he's not rattled. If he has a bad drive or a bad outing, he comes right back and has it. He has a short memory, Mark, and that's a good thing for him. If you look at that game, if you remember when the pass was thrown to Benny Fowler drops it in the end zone, and he goes right back to him, I believe, a drive later, and he scores a touchdown. I mean, Connor does a great job of saying, okay, that drive didn't go well, but we're going to come back, stick to the game plan, and make the play. And he does a great job at that, Mark. If you remember the Purdue game when it was the offense struggle, 14-0.
Right.
The next week, he forgets about the whole thing and throws up about four touchdowns. So Connor Cook, I think, definitely from a confidence standpoint, means a lot to this MSU offense. And I think the overall psyche of the receivers finally catching balls, that has a lot to do with it too, Mark.
Tell us a little bit about what's coming up on the TV show this week. That's Thursday night on WKAR-TV, Current Sports TV.
Yes, this Thursday we will have Bob Every, who is the Greater Lansing Sports Hall of Fame. He's the chairman of the Greater Lansing Sports Hall of Fame. He's a famed boxer in the area, legendary boxer here in the area. He's also been a coach at LCC Softball. He's done a lot, Mark, but he should be a great guest. We also had him on a radio show. He's great.
Very good. Al Martin, the host of Current Sports on AM 870 WKAR every afternoon at 1 o'clock, as well as the host of Current Sports Television on WKAR-TV every Thursday night. Thanks, Al. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you.
That is our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, we explore Michigan's blue economy, an effort to accelerate the state's water-based industries. That and more tomorrow on Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for joining us for Current State on WKAR.